You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of May 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
But you say you talk to Kim.
I would speak to him. I have no problem with speaking to him.
Donald Trump says he'd be willing as president to meet Kim Jong-un. Would Kim Jong-un be willing to meet him? My guests Mary Dajewski and Michael Binion will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including Venezuela's president declares that the country is in a state of emergency. Many Venezuelans could have told him that some time ago. The question of what use a president should make of their partner when their partner was also a president. Have we yet really figured out a role for the spouses of our leaders?
It's not easy being the spouse of a candidate, even less so being the spouse of an MP or a minister.
And why will the sky above the graduates of one English university now go undarkened by deliriously hurled hats? That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Michael Binion, a foreign affairs specialist at The Times, and Mary Dajewski, columnist at The Independent and The Guardian. Welcome both. We shall start with this.
But you say you talked to Kim.
I would speak to him. I have no problem with speaking to him.
It is not easy to be sanguine about the prospect of the security of Southeast Asia being hashed out between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. One is a blustering, paranoid demagogue with ridiculous hair and a detached relationship with verifiable reality, emboldened by a cult of belligerently unreasonable adherence, and the other is, yes, the chairman of the Workers' Party of Korea. Trump has nevertheless indicated a willingness to talk directly to the DPRK, assuming that he knows what and or where it is, what could possibly go wrong. Mary, first of all, in fairness to Donald Trump, which is always a fun phrase to say out loud, how different is this from Obama saying much the same thing in 2007?
It's not a huge amount of difference. It simply means that a candidate for the top office in the United States doesn't want to rule anything out, even anything as seemingly absurd as talking one-on-one with the leader of North Korea. I have to say, too, in a sort of over-realistic way, which is that Trump was actually answering a question. So if you accuse him of giving a sort of fantastical answer, then it's actually the question that was equally fantastical. And he was asked, would you speak to the North Korean leader? And he said, not unreasonably, yes.
Michael, put that way, in that if we're going to agree that Donald Trump has actually given a reasonable answer to a question, and bless that, and may it set an encouraging precedent, why hasn't Barack Obama talked to North Korea? He said he would, or at least wouldn't object to the idea, and he's had an entire presidency to do it, and he hasn't.
Well, North Korea is a somewhat erratic partner, and I think Barack Obama, if North Koreans had offered him an opening, might have sent, well, not himself, but his Secretary of State, possibly Hillary Clinton, to go and talk to the North Koreans. After all, the present leader's father did engage in a sort of dialogue at some point with some senior American statesman. But Kim Jong-un has simply offered no opening for Barack Obama to do anything of the sort. I mean, he's been taken a course that is not only belligerent and erratic, but in some respects wholly irrational and completely dangerous. So it would not really gain Barack Obama anything, even if he had offered to talk to him.
Mary, are we learning anything yet about what Donald Trump's foreign policy outlook may be? So far, the only two world leaders for whom he has actually offered any praise whatsoever really are Kim Jong-un and Vladimir Putin, which is a strange place to be coming from when running for president of the United States.
Yes, it doesn't seem especially calculated to recommend him to American voters, does it? But I think what's interesting about, say, particularly the consistent, relatively positive noises he's made about Putin are that as somebody who comes from outside the established political world, somebody who might see himself as not carrying the baggage of the Cold War, that he thinks that he somehow senses, I think, in Putin a sort of kindred spirit that he might actually be able to talk to and get more out of than, say, Obama. Because I think Obama's relations with Putin have been among the worst between an American and a Russian and before that a Soviet leader.
And that's saying something.
That is saying quite a lot.
Michael, what do you think? Are you getting any sense yet of a coherent foreign policy framework from Donald Trump? Because the thing that strikes me is that so far his big sort of applause lines, his big leitmotifs have been like pounding a lectern and insisting that America should be doing things it's actually already doing, like fighting Islamic State and working to keep Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. He keeps saying, like, we must do these things, and you can only respond, you are.
Well, I think Donald Trump is pretty clever in that he's done all the nasty stuff first. He's done all the stuff that whips up the voters, that gets them excited, that gets them thinking, here's a man who's gutsy and not afraid to say the blunt truth, particularly about immigrants, Mexicans and others. Some rather nasty things, very unpleasant things he said. Now that power is within sight, he's suddenly appearing a reasonable man. I don't think he has a very coherent foreign policy, but he's getting a number of foreign policy advisers who are saying, now look, don't rule anything out. Don't put yourself into a corner. Keep open your options. Keep flexible. Look as though you're a sort of worldly, reasonable man ready to do business on America's behalf. You've already established the reputation of being a tough guy who can't be pushed around. Now you want to show you're a reasonable man as well.
Mary, on that subject of Trump perhaps becoming more reasonable, or at least having to look like he's becoming more reasonable, at some point, if it's not happening already, at some point he is going to begin to get access to classified intelligence briefings as the presumptive nominee of the opposition party. Is that the kind of thing that may actually calm him down a bit as he is acquainted with, you know, a few realities of the job? Or is there actually a whole other concern, the idea that Donald Trump, a man whose discretion is at best questionable, is going to be allowed the run of the top secret files?
Well, I think it's at quite a late stage that the official nominee gets access to intelligence. So I think we're a way away from that yet. But I think I think Trump is sufficient of an American to think that loyalty and keeping state secrets is something that he would do and he would respect. What I think the greater danger is that he's given all this stuff to read and he's given all sorts of high-level intelligence briefings. And while he doesn't actually say this in public, he might actually harbour a deep contempt for what he reads. Because as you sort of understand from talking to people who have anything to do with intelligence, and I gather that there were times when, for instance, Margaret Thatcher looked at the intelligence briefings and simply said, well, that's rubbish, I don't accept that. And there are ways in which I think, you know, Blair is the classic example, leaders have been encouraged maybe to take too seriously the intelligence briefings that they're given. So maybe Trump would be, as it were, a healthy alternative.
Well, I think one further danger is that, of course, he's looking at intelligence that goes back some years, and if it goes back only 4 years, he will be looking at intelligence of what Hillary Clinton did when she was Secretary of State, and he cannot be the one to resist the idea of using that, saying, I happen to know that when she was Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton did this and this and this, and in fact having an unfair advantage over her in the final stretch of the campaign.
But there's already two very inflammatory issues from her time as Secretary of State that are completely or apparently completely in the public domain. One of them is the matter of the emails and the special service. She had a personal email account, which she used for State Department business. And the other is the matter of the killing of the American ambassador to Libya in Benghazi. And both of those, I think, cast long shadows over Hillary's possibilities.
Well, let's take a look now at Venezuela, which is a task which should be less infuriating than it is. The country has a population of just 30 million people and the world's largest proven oil reserves. It would require considerable effort, you would think, to turn it into a dysfunctional and rancorous basket case. Its current government has found a way, however, and President Nicolas Maduro, having worked his way from beset to embattled to downright beleaguered, has now declared a 60-day state of emergency as his legion opponents plan further demonstrations. Michael, the more you read about this, the weirder a place Venezuela appears to be getting to in an extremely big hurry. His state of emergency for 60 days, but presumably to be repeated ad infinitum, has been rejected by Parliament. Maduro has said it's going to happen anyway. It's a weird idea to think of a country's actual president staging a coup d'etat, but is something of the sort underway here?
Oh, undoubtedly. What he wants to do is effectively annul the result of the parliamentary election. And he's found several ways of doing this. One is to declare most of the parliamentary acts since the opposition has been in the majority simply illegal, unconstitutional, refer them to the Supreme Court, who are his own placemen and who routinely throw back all the legislation the opposition comes up with. He then declares that the referendum is itself unconstitutional and cannot go ahead and is invalid. And once you've declared that, then you say that the parliament has no power, and then you actually then you effectively give yourself an enabling act. That's the same useful little phrase that Hitler had when he made himself above parliamentary censure or parliamentary opposition. And that is what he's trying to do. He does not accept the fact that he and his cronies have effectively been thrown out.
Mary, I spent 5 days in Caracas in 2007 and or 2008, and am therefore
it's more than I've ever spent.
and am therefore an expert, obviously. But this was, you know, when the Hugo Chavez personality cult was at its peak. The country was less chaotic than it has become since. Is the problem basically that Maduro is still trying to operate a personality cult without a personality?
I think that's a very sort of clever way of putting it. And if that's what he's trying to do, he's obviously failing rather badly. Because, of course, Chavez was one of a kind, and the sort of popular support that he commanded is not something that Maduro has anything like as much. And you look at, I just look at the pictures of the opposition and the protests and the what seems to be happening there. On the one hand, it seems to justify, in a strange way, a state of emergency. But the other thing is that the language that's coming from Maduro is pretty scary, because he's talking about external enemies, including the US, presenting real threats. He's talking about, or at least hinting, that the military might be somewhere there in the background. And when you look at the past of South America, you think, they've done with all that, and thank goodness. And yet, if it comes back in Venezuela, you know, that is a huge step back.
This is basic stuff from the threatened demagogues playbook, though, isn't it?
Absolutely.
You blame foreigners, you blame the military, you blame sinister conspiracies. He's also blaming, as he puts it, the country's elite for boycotting Venezuela's economy. I'm not even really sure what that actually means. But on the subject of scary language, Michael, it does have to be said that some of the rhetoric emanating from the opposition camp is possibly not terrifically helpful either. The opposition leader, Henri Capriles, has actually publicly called on the army to choose between the constitution and the president. Is that helpful sort of talk in this sort of situation?
Well, the opposition is simply saying it's him or us, and which are you going to choose? Because he is going to call on you in one way or another. As Mary said, he's either hinting at putting the army in charge in a kind of quasi-military capacity as military government with him at the head of it, or he is fearful that the opposition will do the same. And the military are the only people, in the end, who can probably remove either one or the other, because the forces are pretty evenly pitted, although I have to say more and more ordinary people are moving towards the opposition camp as they're so fed up with the shortages. So I think, yeah, it's inviting a military coup, effectively, by both sides.
Mary, the shortages to which Michael alludes are astonishing, and they are merely the visible aspect, I guess, of Venezuela's economic disaster. Its economy is shrinking by 8%. Inflation is tipped to reach anything up to 2,000% next year. And there is nothing stopping Venezuela, as far as I can see, from being a wealthy, secure and prosperous country. It is absurd. Maduro is effectively continuing a program which is nearly 20 years old, if you date it from the beginning of the Hugo Chavez presidency. How long do you think he can get anybody at all to buy the idea that this is all someone else's fault?
I mean, it's very hard to look at this and say anything other than the time is rapidly running out, because, you know, you're looking at shortages, you're looking at street protests on an escalating scale. You cited the inflation rate. Now, how long can all that go on? Now, Maduro may say, well, yes, you know, I've declared a state of emergency and nobody's accepting it. But the fact is that, I mean, it's sort of classic ingredients of total chaos. And I can't see a single redeeming feature here.
Is there, Michael, for all Maduro's bluster about, foreigners plotting his downfall as if the world's foreigners have got nothing better to do with their time, is there a role that any outside power could or should play? China in particular has lent Venezuela $65 billion to keep the lights on a couple of days a week. Should an outside backer, an outside potentate, take Maduro to one side at this point and say, I think you're done? Or is this something that Venezuela should be left to sort out for itself?
Well, it should be left to sort out for itself because the precedent of foreign intervention is always a bad one. But I think it wouldn't be surprising if a number of Venezuela's so-called friends are saying to him, actually, you know, time is running out for you. And the obvious ones who could say that are the Cubans, because Venezuela has modelled itself, or Hugo Chavez did model himself on Castro, or tried to, and created a sort of bond of left-wing so-called progressive states against the Yankee imperialism and all that. The Cubans are becoming slightly more realistic. They understand what is what and what works and what doesn't. The Chinese might say that, but I think all other potential friends of Venezuela have more or less just said, well, he's finished. We'll just wait now. And they don't need to intervene because, as Mary says, time is running out very quickly. And in the end, it will be the army itself who themselves are suffering from the shortages. They will probably take action.
Mary, just final thought on this. On the subject of friends of Venezuela, why was it, do you think, that so many in the West in particular, especially in Europe, were so keen for so long to make, if not excuses, then certainly apologies for Hugo Chavez?
I think from the outside, he looked quite an attractive character, and it looked as though he was getting something to work that alternative sort of types of politician hoped would be able to work elsewhere in the world. You know, the sort of anti-austerity program that people were advocating almost everywhere else and was being dismissed as completely unrealistic. You looked at Chavez, you'd got somebody who'd got enormous public popularity, he'd got what was essentially a super anti-austerity program. He had supreme popular touch, and it all looked absolutely wonderful if you weren't actually going to have an election and consider who came after.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Mary Dujewski and Michael Binion. Coming up, what's it like being married to a world leader when you're hugely successful in your own right?
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time, make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Mary Dujewski and Michael Binion. Let's take a listen to this.
You know, everyone thought I was a snob and hated politics. Well, Jack never made me feel that I was a liability to him, but I was. Then when we got in the White House, all the things that I'd always done suddenly became wonderful. And I was so happy for Jack, especially now that it was only 3 years together, that he could be proud of me then. So those were happiest years.
Between 80 and 83, Tony and I were both looking for seats, and there was a time for about 6 to 9 months when Tony was the candidate's husband. It's not easy being the spouse of a candidate, even less so being the spouse of an MP or a minister.
When we met 45 years ago, we fell in love. I thought she was the most amazing person because everything she touched, she made better.
Yes, I made mistakes. I don't think I did any harm to Margaret by my mistakes. If I did, I didn't realize it. You know, the longer you keep your mouth shut, the safer you are.
And a point for each one of those you can name. Those were some famous political spouses and one possible famous political spouse to be. Should Hillary Clinton win the presidency in November, the White House will be faced with an interesting question of protocol, i.e. what to call her husband. Like all former presidents, Bill Clinton is entitled to be addressed forevermore as Mr. President. But for the avoidance of confusion, would he need to be repurposed as the first gentleman or similar? And what role, if any, should we play in Ms. President's administration? Michael, first of all, it is a weird point. What should we call him? How should he be addressed? Vice presidents and presidents, as you know, are entitled to retain that nomenclature.
You could say
it would be very weird having two running around.
You can't say
White
Mr. Ex-President. I mean, that sounds ridiculous. I think they would say, when he's alone, Mr. President, when he's with his wife, they would say, Madam President and Your Excellency, Mr. Clinton. And they would probably have to call him his name. Otherwise, it sounds ridiculous. But, that's only one of... That's the least of their problems, I think.
This is not a conversation the Founding Fathers, and they were very much fathers, had, obviously. Mary, possibly the more important question is what, in this eventuality, Bill Clinton should actually do. Hillary has quite wisely, I suspect, ruled him out of a cabinet post, but has talked about putting him in charge of what she calls economic revitalization.
I think that would be quite dangerous, actually. I think you want to put him in a fairly non-job that involves him touring the backwoods of the United States.
Ambassador to Mongolia or something.
That would probably be perfect. Because I think the problem with Bill Clinton is the problem that really no other male spouse actually faces. First of all, he has served as president for 8 years. And second, he is a huge character in his own right. It's very difficult to see, you know, even when Hillary is out campaigning and in her own right, Bill somehow, he's still hovering there in the background, and she sort of needs him to be there, but she also needs him not to be there so that she can be a candidate in her own right. But I think when you look at other male leaders' consorts, I think Dennis Thatcher did a terrific job of keeping sort of in the background but with a low profile, and Angela Merkel's husband Joachim Sauer is doing exactly the same, being very discreet, supportive in the background, eating whatever she cooks for dinner, occupying the Chancellor's flat, and otherwise not being seen.
Well, on the subject of Chancellor Merkel's husband, I had literally no idea who he was or what he did or what he looked like until I started researching this item a couple of hours ago, which does speak volumes for that discretion you describe. Michael, I just wonder, though, is that an option really only available, the media being what it is, to male spouses? Would it really be possible for the female spouse of a global leader, even if she really wanted to disappear completely from view?
No, I don't think so, because she adds a big bonus to most male presidents or leaders. And you just have to look. I mean, sometimes they so overshadow them that they effectively run the government. Take Eva Perón, for example. She's so overshadowed her husband, Juan Perón, that she was the one that was remembered and possibly influenced all the policies. Take Michelle Obama. She doesn't make decisions, but she is 10 times more popular. Well, certainly more popular than her husband at the moment. The more interesting one is, say, a woman leader or prime minister with a husband who is himself a politician in another country. For example, the former prime minister of Denmark, whose husband is an MP in the British Labour Party. And so when he goes to Denmark, he's Mr. Spouse of, a senior politician. And when she comes here, ex-Prime Minister of Denmark, she is effectively just the wife of an MP.
But I think Michael's is a very retro way of looking at it. I absolutely disagree. I think that the time when a presidential or prime minister's spouse, wife, should be in the spotlight and it should be expected that they operate as a couple in power, I think that is the it's taken straight from the playbook of the past. And I think that one of the good things that Samantha Cameron's actually done in the UK is to take a much more sort of backseat role. And she very rarely goes to international meetings with her husband. She does things by herself. She gives reception. She does charity work. I'm not sure that leaders' spouses should be expected even to do that. I think that the person in power should be operating by themselves, and to have or not to have a consort, we should actually go back to Ted Heath. He didn't have a consort of any sort. Nobody remarked on it.
Well, I'm not disagreeing with Mary, because I actually agree that it is wrong to expect the spouse to... an unelected official to have to play a role as just sort of prettifying the job. All I meant is that that is what in the past they have done or have been expected to do. And I completely agree they shouldn't be expected to do that, just as nowadays the wives of male diplomats are not expected necessarily to be there in the embassy, and the other way around. Similarly, female diplomats, you don't have to have your husband dragging or the plate of canapés across the floor all the time.
But also it's partly America's fault, because the United States is so much sort of the iconography of the world to have the President and the First Lady side by side in the White House.
Yes.
And this is all about conservative society in America. It's all about happy American families. And I think, you know, we should actually look at this and say, no, you know, the future is different.
Can anybody name the last bachelor elected president of the United States?
That's a long time ago. Wasn't it Garfield?
It was not. It was Grover Cleveland.
Grover Cleveland,
who did
yes.
subsequently get married during his first term.
Yes.
I did look that up. But we should move on from that, because finally tonight, listeners unfamiliar with Britain's more excitable newspapers may be unfamiliar with the health and safety gone mad trope beloved of certain columnists. This generally involves seizing upon some well-meaning regulation and declaring it a handcart track to hell. God help us if there's a war, and so forth. Said commentators will presently be pounding their keyboards exuberantly at the news that the University of East Anglia has requested that graduates desist from hurling their mortarboard hats in the air, lest the pointy corners have someone's eye out. Mary, in fairness, there have been at the UEA injuries in the last 2 years, one requiring hospital treatment. Is this a reasonable response?
I think it's a completely absurd response, but I think there's something even more absurd.
Are you building up to a "it's health and safety gone mad" column yourself?
No, I'm going to say that I find it completely absurd that University of East Anglia, which is a new university, so-called, should have anything to do with mortarboards at all. I mean, when I went to college, I went to an old established university and we had gowns and mortarboards, fine. But the whole thing about new universities, the universities that were set up in the 60s and thereafter, was that they were against all that stuff. And gradually, all the mortarboards and the gowns and everything have come creeping back to the ceremonies and the degree ceremonies as though this somehow validates a degree. I think this is just ridiculous. They should have done away with the mortarboards and never brought them back.
Well, see, speaking as a two-time dropout of the University of Sydney, this was never an issue for me. But, Michael, would you characterise yourself a mortarboard hurler or not?
Well, I went to a traditional university and we didn't have mortarboards. I don't think I ever hired one. We had gowns for the ceremony. Everybody wants a ceremony at the end. That's true. New or old universities, they all want a ceremony. And we had to be led up. In fact, we had to hold the finger of the sort of president of the Senate. It. And he would lead four up at a time to the stage, and then you were, you know, called out and given a certificate or something absurd. But I don't remember mortarboards. I mean, that really does seem a bit odd. But hurling them into the air, well, if you don't like them, hurl them in the air. What seems particularly absurd is the photographers saying, well, why don't you pretend to hurl them in the
air? This is a glorious detail.
Yes. The photographers who make a lot of money photographing the ceremonies have urged the students, if you want to do it, pretend you're throwing them up, and we will Photoshop the picture. So we'll put in the mortarboards where we think they'll be in this vigorous, exuberant celebration. And then for £8 extra, you can have your mortarboard in the picture as well.
I did like the £8. It seemed a curiously precise figure. I might just take the next logical step and Photoshop a degree. I mean, who would know in this day and age? That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. The show was produced by Rhys James, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Hannah Ritchie. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Thanks, of course, to my special guests, Michael Binion and Mary Dijewski. There's music next. Then at 1900 hours, it's The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. And there's more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. I've been Andrew Muller. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.